my own.
Mr. Memphis Slim there, and I Love My Baby from a Del Mar issue called The Comeback from Memphis Slim. Plus, Sonny Boy Williamson off of a disc entitled More Real Folk Blues came out through Chess Records back in 1964. That's She's My Baby from Sonny Boy Williamson. Up next here is John Cephas and Phil Wiggins. This is from their release Sweet Bitter Blues. I Saw the Light is what they say. From Cephas and Wiggins here on the Deep Blues Hour.
One morning when I was walking along.
WRCT Pittsburgh is a mistress, a wife, a pen friend, a checkout girl, a complimentary moist lemon-scented cleansing square, or a handy freshen-up wipette. WRCT is the breath of God, the dew on a fresh apple. It's the soft rain of dust that falls into a shaft of morning sun when you pull from an old bookshelf a forgotten volume of romantic diaries. It's a half-remembered childhood birthday party, a creak on the stair, a sputtering match held to a frosted pane, the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking nappy, the hulk of a charred panzer, the underside of a granite boulder, the first downy growth on the upper lip of a Mediterranean girl, cobwebs long since overrun by an old Wellington boot.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember human rights attorney Michael Ratner, founder of Law and Disorder Radio 20 years ago. He was one of the great attorneys of his generation and appreciated worldwide as the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We'll then hear a rare interview from our Lawyers You'll Like series with attorney Peter Weiss, who passed in November 2025. Peter was the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and founder of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. When Michael Ratner died 9 years ago, we produced several shows in his honor. We interviewed clients and colleagues, including Julian Assange, Columbia Law School friend and climate lawyer Eleanor Stein, labor lawyer Richard Levy, and the former head of the ACLU legal department, David Cole. Let's listen.
On January 4th, British Judge Baratzer made her decision on whether to extradite Julian Assange to the USA for trial under the Espionage Act. Julian is the Australian journalist and publisher of truth-telling WikiLeaks. He was headquartered in London when 10 years ago he blew the whistle on the U.S. Army's war crimes in Iraq. He released a video of an American helicopter shooting down 12 civilians, including children and two Reuters journalists. It went viral, totally embarrassing the United States. When Julian was first fingered, Michael knew that it was an important case. He got on a plane and flew over to London to offer to represent Julian. He was Julian's lawyer from that day on until the day he died. Michael knew that free journalism was at stake. Here's Julian Assange talking about Michael.
Michael started out his law career essentially as a liberal, believing in the rule of law and believing that the law was a means to obtain justice on average. But by the end of the 1960s, through experience in trying to apply the law to defend people, he had come to understand something that I've come to understand, which is the application of the law is primarily designed to ensure that existing power inequalities are reinforced. That is to keep private property in the hands of the wealthy and keep and privileges which are accumulated by establishments in their hands. And that is the primary purpose of law and the primary purpose of the judicial system. I think we should celebrate Michael, but also learn from the very positive example that Michael has set over more than 40 years of work.
Well, I came to Columbia in 1966 to go to law school. And, you know, by the end of law school, I took an extra year, 1970, it was a completely transformed place, not completely, but certainly on its way, partly as a result of what happened here in 1968 when the buildings were taken over, but partly because of what was sweeping the country. I mean, the Vietnam War, the sort of beginning of the tail end of Jim Crow in the South, that struggle had reached its apex. King was actually killed in 68. Kennedy was killed in 63, so it sort of bookended by that. But and of course, Robert Kennedy was killed in 68 as well. So you start off at a university. I go to the law school, and at that point, I think it's still classes 6 days a week. The year before, they had just abolished ties and jackets. It's almost all men, 300 men, maybe 15 women. The women's room was a closet. The men's room went the entire width of the building. So that's what the law school was. There wasn't one female teacher. There wasn't one African-American teacher, entirely white. And it was really looked at more as a feeding school for law firms that served Wall Street and the business community of New York.
Now, we go to an interview that Michael Smith did with Michael Ratner's lifelong friend, attorney and climate law professor Eleanor Stein. She was a student and a comrade of Michael's at Columbia Law School in the mid-1960s.
Eleanor, you and Michael were at Columbia Law School together in that historically momentous year of 1968. I'm thinking about the late spring of 68. The students took over several of the buildings, barricaded themselves in. You were in one of those barricade buildings. Michael arrived on campus, got himself beat up. Take the story from there and how you got to be such close friends and work with Michael.
Great. Yes, I remember it vividly. And I know those days were an important part of Michael's formative years. And, you know, he had come to Columbia as an avid student, a brilliant student, the son of a privileged family. And by the time he left, he got a very different education, I think, than the one his family expected him to get at Columbia. In fact, different than he expected to get. So it's important to look at the context a little bit. 1968. A year of unparalleled revolution. The French workers had liberated the factories, a general strike. Mexican students were on strike, Japanese students, German students. And it was also the year when over 500,000 American military personnel were serving in Vietnam, and more than 14,000 Americans were killed in combat. And based on that figure, I'd say several hundred thousand Vietnamese were also killed in that year. So Michael got there while the students were in the buildings. He was there standing outside when the police took back the campus, arrested over 1,000 students, and he was pushed to the ground. He was injured. And all around him, he saw students being beaten by the police. And I think that experience, just that moment, really was a revelatory moment for him. The law and his life in the law and his life, the life he had been groomed for by his family, were going to be changing profoundly. And he went on to dedicate his legal work to defending the most vulnerable, soon to international work, to working wherever the U.S. government was oppressing and subjugating people, overthrowing governments, jailing dissidents, stealing resources. And he became one of the great defenders of people around the world and was looked to by them. And I think that, to me, I see three threads that ran through the Columbia days and that really became central to the fabric of his entire life and work. I'd say, first, the fight against racism, which was a key demand at Columbia, to stop the building of a gym for students in one of Harlem's only parks. His resistance to U.S. military domination in the Third World. There was a defense research analysis institution on campus that was later ejected because of the struggles of the students. And maybe most fundamentally, his realization and determination to cast off his own privilege and throw his lot in with those who are fighting against their subjugation by our own government. So I see those three red threads that really carried through for the rest of his life and underlay a lot of his work. You know, he was one of the greatest fighters of our generation, and I'm so glad that we get a chance to honor him and hold him up today, thanks to your work.
Thank you, Eleanor. You have a part in his book that's about to come out, and actually by the time we play this show, it will be out, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Eleanor Stein is in there. You two were dear friends starting in 1968 up until the time that Michael died. Do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
Well, you know, Michael was an important part of my life for almost half a century, and I miss him terribly. He was the most generous friend you could imagine. I once had to ask him for $100 for a mutual friend, a comrade who was in trouble and needed help, but was afraid to ask. And Michael gave me the money. And I said, Michael, how do you decide who to give money to? And he said, I give it to whoever asks.
That was Eleanor Stein talking about Michael Ratner at Columbia. We go next to the powerhouse attorney, Richard Levy. He worked with Michael and the CCR on a number of significant cases, which we are going to discuss with him. Attorney Richard Levy was a close friend of Michael Ratner's from the late 60s, when they were active together in the National Lawyers Guild and in social movements of the time. You had a case with the leader of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party who was drafted into the Army, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, that was a very interesting case and really sort of highlighted Michael's creativity and his broad knowledge. I mean, this was a case that was could have been a run-of-the-mill draft case, but two things happened that were very interesting about it, one of which was that this individual was a Puerto Rican national. He was born in Puerto Rico, and he was a leader, one of the leaders of the PSAP, the Socialist Party, Puerto Rican Socialist Party in New York. And Michael was very, very involved in the whole anti-colonialist movement, and particularly regarding Puerto Rico. So when this guy, Jose, showed up at Whitehall Street, he refused the draft, but he not only refused the draft on the steps of Whitehall Street, the induction center, but he had 1,000 or so of his comrades come, and it was a grand demonstration. So when he was arrested, as he obviously would be, one of the claims that Michael raised, and I raised with him, was that this was a selective prosecution, which was kind of funny, right? Selective prosecution meaning that they picked someone out, you know, for some improper reasons. And this guy, of course, had stepped up and really asked himself virtually to be arrested to demonstrate his opposition to the Vietnam War. So we raised a selective prosecution claim in federal court, and we got a hearing out of it, and we dragged the case on. And also, because of the acute interest in the colonial issue in Puerto Rico, we raised a host of issues that Michael really came up with, because he was versed not only in U.S. law, but in international law. He was very well versed in international law. And so we challenged the prosecution on the grounds of violations of the Geneva Accords, which said you couldn't draft nationals of an occupied territory, which we regarded Puerto Rico as at the time. We raised claims of violations of the UN Charter and the U.S. Constitution and so on. But the breadth of the challenge was unique. And the case, of course, was pushed into so many complicated issues, including having the head of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party in Puerto Rico, Juan Marie Braz, come up and give an affidavit about the whole colonial nature of the occupation of Puerto Rico by the United States. It was a fabulous case, and the reason Michael did all those things was not because they were winnable claims. He did them because they highlighted the important social issues that the party was raising, that all these individuals who were fighting at that time very boldly for independence for Puerto Rico, these issues exemplified the claims that they were making about the interference of the U.S. government on that island. And so, you know, that really became the importance of the case, much more than the individual question of a draft dodger. But that was Michael. You know, that was Michael's, the breadth of his knowledge and the creativity. Just, he was remarkable that way, and of course, very brilliant.
I remember a meeting with Michael and you and several other people in your office years ago about the Mamilla Cemetery case, another case of colonialism. Tell our listeners about that cemetery case, please, and what happened in Israel.
Yeah, again, it was more than a symbolic case, really, although the symbolism was so, so deep. There was a very ancient cemetery in West Jerusalem, and it dated back probably to the 700s, but certainly it interred there were officials and officers and soldiers of the army of the Muslim leader Saladin. Since that time, which was in the 12th century, numbers of very, very prominent Muslim leaders in Palestine were interred in that cemetery. And the Israelis decided to allow the Wiesenthal Center to tear up that cemetery to build, ironically, a museum of tolerance on the site. Would have been laughable if it wasn't such a desecration of the cultural values of so many people who lived in that land and had so many ancestors who were buried at that site. So we prepared with Palestine Legal, with the assistance of Michael and the scholar Rashid Khalidi from Columbia University, a petition to the International Rapporteur for Palestine. And we challenged what was happening there, which was so devastating to people who cared about their culture and their religion and their history. We challenged this at UNESCO. We challenged it under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And again, we were unable to prevail, but it was a way to highlight the kinds of terrible things that Israel was doing to erase the memory and the history of the Palestinian people in that land. Again, it was Michael really focusing in on the people who were on the ground, who had been demonstrating, who had been organizing around these issues, and he was bringing the legal case that would highlight the issues so greatly. It's terrific in that way.
I wanted to ask you about a number of anti-racism cases that you were involved with Michael, and that's the firefighter case where New York City was discriminating against anybody but a white person getting a job as a firefighter. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, that was an outrageous situation that Michael brought us into. I did a lot of class action cases with him, and this was one of them. When he brought the case to me, 2-point-something% of the firefighters in New York City were black, and the city was about 25% black at that time. And you have to know that the firefighting job is a very, very highly regarded and sought-after job. It's very well-paying, it has terrific benefits, and the guys who are in that job love it, absolutely love it. In fact, nationally, it's rated as one of the most satisfying jobs when they ask people, you know, how they feel about their work. Anyway, we brought a very broadly based class action against the New York City Fire Department. We had a very, very prejudicial exam thrown out and a number of very substantial obstacles to hiring knocked out along the way. And in addition, $100 million in damages were paid to applicants who over the previous years had been denied a fair opportunity to survive for those jobs because there was so much discrimination going on in the application. But again, it was Michael picking up on issues where groups were involved. This was the Vulcan Society, as well as the black community generally, but the Vulcan Society was a very old organization made up of a very small number of firefighters actually who made it into the department. But again, it was a community issue of great importance, I think, to the people of New York. I want to say one other thing about Michael Ratner, if I can. I'll take just a minute and say that for a guy with such brilliance and such creativity, and you know, in such prominence in so many ways. He was such a sweetheart. He was such a modest, self-effacing guy, person. You know, an absolutely great lawyer, but never took himself so seriously. He took his issues tremendously seriously, and the politics of the time and the people he was involved with, but not himself. And he was just a lovely, lovely man. He was a mentor to my children. And I guess people will talk about the other side of him, which was he had a tremendous sense of humor, and he was hilariously funny and very silly when he wanted to be. So working with him over close to 50 years was probably the highlight of my own legal career.
Richard Levy, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And we look forward to getting your comments once you've had a chance to read Michael's book, Moving the Bar. You take it easy, Richard. Thank you again.
My pleasure, Michael.
Let's go now to hear directly from Michael Ratner about the Attica Uprising. Michael had just started working for the Center for Constitutional Rights. His first assignment was to go up to the prison to interview people about what happened during Governor Rockefeller's orchestrated massacre.
Now, after I clerked for Constance Baker Motley, the only woman black federal judge, I took a job at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Newly formed, came out of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, giants of the Civil Rights Movement, William Kunstler, Arthur Conoy, Morton Stavis, just giants. And they were the front lines, really, of the Civil Rights Movement and of defending what we're calling the revolution that happened in the 60s. And part of that included the Chicago 7 or 8 case, the one about the protest of the Democratic Convention. They had a whole section defending Vietnam War resistors, soldiers, and others. So it was an incredibly amazing place to be, tiny, a dozen of us there, maybe that, in a loft off like the worst porn district in New York, 42nd Street. Very, not a lot of money, but an exhilarating place to go. And despite where one could go at that point, coming off a clerkship and all that, I decided to go to the center because this is the kind of work I wanted to do. So I walk into the office, which isn't really, no one has separate offices. It's little dividers. It's linoleum floor. It's up a loft. And I'm there really literally 3 or 4 days. It's September 1971. And during that period, Bill Kunstler is up at Attica, where there has been a takeover of what's called D Yard in the prison. And there's hundreds of prisoners who've taken over D Yard. And Bill Kunstler is part of the negotiating committee to try and figure out with the state or to negotiate how this is going to come to an end. Tom Wicker was there, the New York Times reporter, Herman de Badillo, a politician from New York, a prominent set of negotiators. And you have to also remember Attica. I don't remember the numbers, but thousands of prisoners, 90-some percent black and Latino. I think zero is the number of black or Latino guards, all white. So you're talking about, I mean, just deep, deep discrimination, both in the population as well as how it's being guarded. And there were huge legitimate complaints. I mean, Attica looks like a medieval fortress, and it probably was like that inside. So there's the Attica prison has had this takeover, and as you said, there were many prison riots or rebellions, is what we call Attica Rebellion, going on across the country and even in Canada and other places. And Bill's the negotiator, and then finally the negotiations really break down, most likely over the amnesty issue, but perhaps some other issues. One prison guard, as I recall, had been killed. I don't know the circumstances. In fact, no one was ever convicted of his murder in the end. But one prison guard was killed, and the state was run by Nelson Rockefeller, was the governor. We now call him the Butcher of Attica. I mean, he's dead, but I still call him that. And then on, I guess it's September 11th, actually, I think is the day, the same day as the coup in Chile 2 years later. And September 11th, could it be 9/11 also? It's conceivable. I think they were all then. I don't remember the exact day for Attica, but I think September 11th. They say that the negotiators can't go in any longer to negotiate with the prisoners and talk to them. And there's a picture of Bill walking out saying, I just fear the absolute worst.
Bill Kunstler
coming out. I say, I fear the absolute worst. And what happens, you see in film shot of the National Guard who have been called with their big guns to line the walls. You see them raising their fists and their guns, white power, white power. This is the people who were going to supposedly put down.
They actually start chanting, white power.
Yeah, we're going to put down the Attica prison rebellion. And what happens is a massacre. They fire into, mostly arbitrarily, just into the yard, killing, I think, is 32 people and 9 guards, or I don't remember the exact numbers. But they also target some of the more political active people and kill them. So it's murder. Straight murder.
That was Michael Ratner talking about the Attica prison uprising. We now go to the interview I did with David Cole, who started out as a young man at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He was a staff attorney there. He worked with Michael Ratner. He then went on to be a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He's written 8 books. He's argued 3 cases before the Supreme Court. David Cole is presently the National Litigation Director at the American Civil Liberties Union. David Cole, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
David, let's talk about Michael Ratner's legacy. He's known most significantly for the Rasul versus Bush case. Could you please talk about that?
Well, Michael, I mean, I have to start by saying the last time I was on this show, Michael was one of the co-hosts. So it's a bittersweet to be doing this, but totally appropriate that you're celebrating him and his and the publication of his memoir. You know, Michael's legacy is really much broader than Rasul versus Bush. That was the case, the first case challenging the detention of enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, at a time when pretty much everybody, myself included, thought it was hopeless to bring such a case. And indeed, Michael thought it was hopeless to bring such a case, but nonetheless felt like it was important to do as a matter of principle. He was really the motivating force behind the filing of the first lawsuit challenging that detention at Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, they lost in the district court. They lost in the Court of Appeals unanimously. Lo and behold, they prevailed in the Supreme Court of the United States, to the surprise of, you know, I think everybody. What that did was it brought lawyers and judicial oversight to Guantanamo Bay and created for the first time real pressure on the Bush administration to clean up its act and in fact to release many of the people at Guantanamo. When Guantanamo at its height had 775 people detained there, but by the time Bush had left office, he had ordered the release of over 500 of those detainees. None of that would have happened without Rasul versus Bush.
David Cole, suing powerful people was something that Michael did often. He sued Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, Bush Sr. He took on generals. He used the Alien Tort Statute. Could you reflect on that, please?
I think he was always someone who was number one, out for the underdog, and number two, skeptical of power and its abuse, and number three, committed to seeking to challenge the abuse of power, whether it was, you know, an abuse by Ronald Reagan in funding the Contras in Nicaragua, or whether it was Clinton in authorizing a war without congressional authorization, or whether it was suing foreign dictators under the Alien Tort Claims Act. Michael was willing to bring these suits, again, in many instances, without much hope of prevailing, but with an eye towards the critical importance of standing up to power and of bringing attention to bear on the violations so that if the courts didn't do anything about it, maybe the political process would. I don't think Michael, you know, sort of, I don't think he sort of had some, I know he did not have some view that the courts will save us, but he saw the courts as part of a system that was designed to constrain power, but would only do that if people step up take initiative and use the levers that the system provides to do, you know, the unthinkable, to challenge the most powerful, and to bring attention to their wrongdoings.
Could you talk about Michael's inspiring young lawyers, please?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in many respects that is really Michael's living legacy, are the probably hundreds of lawyers who came to be excited by the law and by the possibility of using the law to advance justice by working with Michael. Probably the biggest single case that had that effect was a case he handled when he was at the Center for Constitutional Rights, but also teaching at Yale Law School, teaching a clinic, a human rights clinic, along with Harold Coe, a professor there. This was a time when Haitian refugees were being picked up on the seas and being brought to Guantanamo, long before Guantanamo was a place for for enemy combatants. It was a holding place for Haitian refugees because the government didn't want to bring the Haitian refugees, who they essentially rescued, you know, on the high seas, didn't want to bring them to the United States because if they were worried that if they brought them to the United States, they'd get some rights protections that they wouldn't otherwise have, and it would be harder to sort of get them back to Haiti. And so they brought them to Guantanamo. And Michael and Harold and about 100 students at Yale Law School ultimately worked on a case that established that, in fact, the courts do have jurisdiction over what goes on at Guantanamo, even though it's not on U.S. soil, it's on Cuban soil formally, and ultimately led to the release of many of the people on that island. So the students at Yale Law School who worked with Michael on that case are a who's who of civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights lawyers today in the federal government, in NGOs, doing public defender work, doing impact litigation. And, you know, and I think if you talk to almost any of them, they will say that it was that experience that really transformed them in their views of what you could do with law and what you should do with law. And I know that personally because that was true for me.
David Cole, thank you so much for your remembrance of Michael Ratner, and every success to you.
And that was part of our memorial show for our good friend and colleague Michael Ratner, founder of Law and Disorder Radio more than 20 years ago.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Attorney Peter Weiss was a frequent guest here on Law and Disorder. He discussed pressing issues of the time, from nuclear policy, international human rights law, and the Royal Dutch Shell settlement. In 2007, Peter was a Lawyers You'll Like guest when he was vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Let's have a listen.
As most of you listeners know, the four hosts of the show are all lawyers, and we like to advertise ourselves as Lawyers You'll Like. Well, as part of our next and continuing series, we want to interview lawyers who have been not necessarily well-known, but who have done really significant things with their lives as progressive lawyers. One of those lawyers is Peter Weiss. He's the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He was a refugee from the Holocaust in Europe. He's had an extraordinary career, but an extraordinary career particularly in the idea that human rights are rights that can be enforced and that belong to all of us and that are worldwide rights. He's won some important cases, suing against torturers in the United States, suing to stop nuclear weapons all over the world. A really amazing career. Today we're glad to bring to you a short interview with Peter Weiss, again, one of the more important lawyers still practicing today. Short interview.
Off our series on lawyers you'll like with you, Peter, probably the most popular lawyer in the room. We wanted to give our listeners a little idea of your background. You've been practicing law for quite a long time. I know that you came with your mother from Europe with the bad guys in Hot Pursuit. Can you tell us a little bit about your background before we start talking about the significant cases that you've been involved in?
Yeah, I was born in Vienna. And when the Nazis came in 1938, my parents decided to go to France. I lived there for 2.5 years and then came here in 1941. Went to what was then called Straubmuller Textile High School, now called Charles Evans Hughes, because my parents decided that the first Jews to be killed were going to be the intellectuals, so they wanted me to have a trade.
What and was the trade?
The trade was textile.
Oh, it was a textile
school. Yeah, took a course in weaving.
Amazing.
Power weaving. I got a scholarship from the Ethical Culture Society to go to St. John's College in Annapolis, also known as the Great Books College. And after 2 years there, I was drafted into the Army, eventually wound up in military intelligence because of my languages, mostly German. And then I spent a year after I was demobilized in 1946, I spent a year in Germany working for U.S. military government in its decartelization branch, which was supposed to break up the German cartels. And that didn't last very long because somebody in Washington decided they needed the cartels to fight the commies.
By cartels, we mean big corporations like Krupp and Bayer Aspirin or whatever they are.
IG Farben. IG Farben, so forth. Right. But it was a very exciting time, and it got me interested in the law. Then I went back and finished St. John's. At the end of that two-year period, I applied to a bunch of law schools saying that I wanted to work for what was then going to be the International Trade Organization based in Havana, Cuba, which was...
This is before the revolution, right?
Oh, yeah, long before, 1949. That was supposed to break up the cartels worldwide. And the admissions people at Yale seemed to like that, so I got into Yale Law School. But never did anything about any trust again after that.
And then I know you became a trademark lawyer, which was your specialty, right? An intellectual property, really. Right. But I first knew you, this is Michael Ratner speaking, I first knew you when I went to the center in 71. You were already there at the center. So there must have been some history around then. But of course, I remember you best because at that time, none of us knew anything about international law. And I always tell the story. Peter insisted that we put international law claims into every single piece of litigation we did. So how did you get from Yale to international law and the importance, really, of human rights in international law?
Well, actually, I took an international law course at Yale with one of the great international lawyers of that time, Myers McDougall, former president of the American Society of International Law, who has produced, a number of quite progressive international lawyers like Burns Weston and Richard Falk, but also some conservative ones. But that got me interested in international law, plus my multinational background, having lived in France and been born in Austria. I somehow, for some reason, I believed in international law.
Now, I know you have, I don't know whether to go to the highlights of some of the cases you've done, but they were all highlights in terms of an end goal. So why don't we start with what then was your end goal in terms of international law?
At that time, you guys are all too young to remember that, but the end of the war was a very... progressive period in terms of people's expectations. People thought that was the last big war, and now we were going on to build a peaceful, just world. Some people talked about world government. I actually worked for a few months for a foundation for world government. Others just thought this was going to be the period in history when poverty was going to be done away with. There was a great deal of interest in economic development then. I actually spent my first 2 years after graduating from Yale in 1952 running an organization called the IDPA, the International Development Placement Association, which was a precursor of the Peace Corps. And then at the end of those 2 years, I had to start making a living because the Internal Revenue Service decided that sending young Americans to work in what were then called underdeveloped countries was not something entitled to tax exemption. So IDPA had to go out of business, and I had to go and practice law.
So tell us a little bit about, when you look at your legal career, I mean, what you consider some of the most, I know some of them, but I don't want to say what I consider them. So some of your most significant either litigations or work.
Well, I think there were probably two. One was the Philadelphia case that I did with the center, with my colleagues, Rhonda Copeland, principally, and John Corwin, which brought the Alien Tort Claims Act back to life in 1978. And the other one was a case that I worked on in the 90s at the International Court of Justice, obtaining an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the illegality of nuclear weapons.
Let's go to the first one, Philartica v. Peñarella, which is the Alien Tort Claim Statute. I remember, I being at the center at the time, this was a case in which there was a torture committed in Paraguay against a young man who was killed eventually, and his family happened to come to the United States, and the man who engaged
in the torture eventually came into the United States.
That's
right.
Peñarella.
Right.
And you decided that somehow, even though everything happened in Paraguay, that the United States could actually do something in this case. Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the reason we thought that was because almost 10 years before that, we discovered a very old law going back to the First Judiciary Act of 1789, which in one sentence said that an alien has a right of action in an American court for a tort in violation of the law of nations, which is what they called international law in the 18th century. And the reason we discovered that at the time of my lie is because we were in touch with a then little-known journalist called Seymour Hersh, who got the Pulitzer Prize for exposing the massacre at My Lai in Vietnam.
Well, we're really glad, Peter, to have you with us. Peter Weiss, who is now the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who was there when I started in the early 70s. And we're talking with Peter about the case called Philartica v. Peñarella, which was a torture that occurred in Paraguay. And Peter was giving us some of really the genesis of that case, which is probably the most important human rights case ever brought in the United States, and what the significance is. But first tell us how we won it, Peter, at the center, or how you and Rhonda and Corwin won it.
Well, we lost it in the first instance, even though we had a sympathetic judge. We had Judge Eugene Nickerson in the Eastern District, who used to march with us in the anti-Vietnam marches. When we brought the case to him, made it quite clear that he would have liked to rule for us, but he considered himself bound by a precedent in the Second Circuit. And so then eventually we won it on appeal in the Second Circuit. It has now been held up in 5 or 6 other circuits and in the Supreme Court.
Let's talk about that circuit for a second, because it was extraordinary. What you were saying here is that a person who was tortured in Paraguay, a Paraguayan national, tortured by a Paraguayan police official, that the family of the man who was tortured and killed could bring a suit in the United States. And that's pretty extraordinary.
Yes.
Because I know you're a big person in international law. What was so important to you about that?
It was the fact that not only the courts, but also the State Department. Remember, this was under Jimmy Carter. When I got up to argue that case before the Second Circuit, Judge Kaufman of Rosenberg fame interrupted me after the first 2 or 3 sentences and said, Mr. Weiss, what does the State Department think of this case? And I said to myself very quietly, what's going on here? You know, I mean, I was taught in law school that we're supposed to have an independent judiciary here. But what I said to the judge was, well, there are people in the State Department who like this case, and there are people in the State Department who don't like it. But I don't think it should matter what people in the State Department think, because you're the judge. Now, as it happened, one of the people who eventually wrote the State Department position on this, which Judge Kaufman requested about 5 minutes after the hearing was over, he told his clerk to write to the State Department and ask for a State Department position. And one of the people to whom this came was a wonderful man named Charles Runyon, who used to be the assistant dean at Yale when I was there, and a great proponent of human rights. And that was the brief period, you know, when human rights were really being taken seriously by the State Department. So the brief that the State Department submitted supported the case, and I'm convinced that had it been the other way, we would have lost the case. So well, we didn't really win it before Judge Kaufman. We won it in the State Department.
I think that's a really important point. And, of course, the period was, again, Jimmy Carter's presidency, 76 to 80. It was right after the Vietnam War. It was a president who at least espoused human rights, and it was a special period, I think, in our American history. Now, Judge Kaufman did have some ringing language in that opinion, which you might want to tell our listeners.
Well, the ringing language you got out of our briefs.
And what is it, Pete? What?
The ringing language was, with this decision, the torturer, like the pirate of old, has become hostis humani generis, the enemy of all mankind. We lifted it from somewhere, and he lifted it out of our brief.
Now, I think there's a couple of ways to go here. That was, as you said, it was a big victory. And, of course, when we look at even the center's current work on the Rumsfeld case and the Pinochet case and bringing international human rights violators to justice, this case is really the cornerstone. And it's also the cornerstone for a lot of other work in the alien tort claims area. And why don't you just give us some overview of that work, and then we'll go on to your next big legal precedent.
Well, it's the beginning of a development in international law which may well turn out to be the most important development of this century in international law. And that is something called universal jurisdiction. And precisely the fact that some crimes are so heinous that they should be subject to trial in any country in the world. Now, we haven't quite gotten there yet, but we do have the Alien Tort Statute in the United States, we have the International Criminal Court, and we have an increasing number of countries which have enacted legislation to implement the principle of universal jurisdiction. And it's, for instance, under the German universal jurisdiction law, which says that a war crime, crime against humanity, aggression, or genocide can be prosecuted by the German prosecutor regardless of where it happens and regardless of where the perpetrator is located. Unfortunately, almost 60 cases have been brought on that so far in Germany, and not a single one has been followed up by the prosecutor. So that's a wonderful example of the hypocrisy of legislators and prosecutors.
And, of course, Peter and I in the Center for Constitutional Rights are co-counsel in the Rumsfeld case in Germany, which was recently dismissed, but again, on the universal jurisdiction basis is what we brought.
I think we should mention, because we need a laugh here, I think we should mention the ground on which the case was dismissed both times.
You're making me laugh already because I know what you're going to say.
The official ground of the prosecutor was that there was no reason to believe that Rumsfeld wouldn't be prosecuted in the United States.
So all our listeners can just take a good laugh at that, because that's not going to happen while we're around. Anyway, so Peter, that I know is one of the, I mean, the many significant events in your career, and it's a short interview. But the other area is...
Well, we wanted to talk to you about your work on trying to stop nuclear proliferation. We know you're the president of an organization that's trying to bring about that through law, and that you've been active in that for many decades.
The first thing to do about it is to get away from the word non-proliferation, because non-proliferation in the non-proliferation treaty is another word for nuclear apartheid. In other words, the five official nuclear weapons states, which interestingly also happen to be the five states that have the veto in the Security Council, the U.S., France, the U.K., Russia, and China, want to hold on to their nuclear weapons, and they don't want anybody else to have them, right? We got them, you can't get them. That's their view of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is a total violation of the treaty itself, which one of my colleagues in this area always says, whenever you talk about it, you have to call it the Treaty for Non-Proliferation and for Total Nuclear Disarmament, because that's what it was intended to be, because Article 6 of the treaty says, here's the deal. You guys, the rest of the world, stay away from nuclear weapons, and we who have them will negotiate in good faith to get rid of them. That second part has been buried. And back in 1995, my colleagues in this country and in many other countries, because I used to be at that time president of the International Association for Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, which has chapters in quite a few countries, and we lobbied the General Assembly of the United Nations to put a question to the International Court of Justice, which is the highest tribunal for questions of international law in the world. And the question basically was, is the threat or use of nuclear weapons legal or illegal under international law? And that was based on the fact that international law prohibits many of the characteristics of nuclear weapons, the principal one being that there is no way to limit that weapon to what weapons are supposed to do, namely kill soldiers. And there's no way to discriminate between soldiers and civilians if a nuclear weapon is ever used. And there are other things like violations of neutrality and so forth. And we got a majority of the General Assembly to put the question to the International Court. We had 3 weeks of hearings before the International Court of Justice in The Hague, where we were in touch with various governments that submitted briefs or argued in person before the court. It was the case which involved a greater number of countries participating than any previous case in the history of the International Court of Justice and its predecessor, the Permanent Court of International Arbitration, since 1922. And, well, you know, one interesting aspect of it was that countries testify or argue before the court in alphabetical order. And so the last two countries, it seemed, when we were there to argue, were going to be the United States and the UK. And knowing that judges are frequently influenced by the last presentations made to them, we had to do something. So what do? We got Zimbabwe. And we stayed up all night with the local representative, and Zimbabwe made a beautiful presentation to the court. So it was about 9 months later that they came out with a ruling saying, in effect, the threat and use of nuclear weapons is generally illegal under international law. And then they did something remarkable. The last sentence in this very long decision answered a question that we hadn't even put to them. And they said, there is a general obligation, meaning an obligation binding on all countries in the world, to negotiate in good faith and pursue to a conclusion a treaty providing for the elimination of all nuclear weapons. And they were, and the words in good faith are in there, taken from Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So at this point, we in the anti-nuclear legal community, or the anti-nuclear activist community, are considering going back to the court and, with the help again of the General Assembly, asking a new question. When the highest tribunal in the world dealing with international law questions has said that there is a general obligation to do something in good faith, how long can countries wait to implement that? Because it's been 11 years now.
So, Peter, you've had a long, amazing career, won some really important cases. How do you look at the future? I mean, you know, I would say from our position at the center and from yours, you know, there's some bleak things that have happened, certainly in this last period. How do you keep going? What makes you...
If you've been associated with the Center for Constitutional Rights as long as I have been, which is since 1969... You have to have faith in the future, because otherwise we'd be wasting our time, right?
It's true, Peter.
So things are pretty bleak. We've just had three bad 5-4 decisions from the Supreme Court 2 days ago. But as long as there are places like the center and people like the lawyers who work at the center and in other organizations that do Guantanamo work and human rights work and so forth, I take a long view, and I think at some point human rights will become the, I'm going to interrupt myself here and quote Justice Marshall. Justice Thurgood Marshall of the Supreme Court said in a speech he gave that the law is the glue that holds society together. And I think human rights will become the architecture of society. So you need the full implementation of human rights, all human rights for all people, as it says in the United Nations. But you also need lawyers who bring the kind of cases that we've been bringing at the center, and you need judges who have the courage to deal with them.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Peter Weiss, Vice President of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and this is Michael Ratner. And Peter, I just want to, you know, I've been really working with you since 71 when I came to the center, and it's been just one of the, you know, the great pleasures and learning experiences of my life. So thank you for everything, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard a 2007 interview from our Lawyers You'll Like series, remembering attorney Peter Weiss.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. And there you'll learn ways to pledge your support for the show, and we appreciate that as well.
Lyme disease is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year. Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.LymeDiseaseAssociation.org.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number two, discount tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.